High Park United Methodist Church in Tampa, Florida. This is the Bible Project 2020, a journey to reading the Bible without fear or frustration. I'm Monica Largis, a former virtual intern at Hyde Park and a current student at Yale Divinity School. I'm talking to you today from my home in Vienna, Austria. I'm your host today. On this week's episode, Matt Hotho and I have a conversation with Dr. Aaron Heim about Paul. Aaron Heim earned a PhD from the University of Otago, a master's in New Testament from Denver Seminary, and a Bachelor of Music from the University of Minnesota. She has written many articles and essays on Pauline theology, theological interpretation of scripture, and metaphor in the Bible. Aaron is also a co-host of the popular podcast about biblical studies and theology called On Script. She is also a tutor in biblical studies at Oxford University. Our conversation helps reconstruct the life of Paul through the New Testament, starting with Paul's religious upbringing. Aaron explains how Paul's theology develops over the timeline of the New Testament. We look at Paul as a bridge between Gentile and Jewish cultures. We finish up with a discussion of the end of his life. Now, on to the episode.
Paul that we meet in Acts 8 is Saul of Tarsus. And we don't actually have like a ton of information about Paul or Saul. And what we do get about Paul's life or Saul's life, we get mostly from Acts, because Acts is giving us a history and not his letters, which are written to a specific congregation or to a specific person. And so they don't read like a bio. You know, how often do you include like a bio in an email or something like that? So we shouldn't maybe expect that he's going to give us lots of details about his life. But Luke does, because Luke is trying to put together an account of the happenings of the early church. And so when we read Acts, we need to recognize that there's a few kind of fixed dates that we can kind of hang our timeline of the entire life of Paul. And that data that comes from Acts, we have two sort of really fixed points in Acts. One of them is that we know Paul was in Corinth in 51 CE. And the other one is that we know he was imprisoned in Caesarea in 58 to 59 CE. And so all of the other data that we can we have for Paul's life, or what we know of Paul's life, we kind of have to fit around those two dates. And then the date of the crucifixion. So there's not a lot to go on. I think I'd want to say that first, in terms of like actual dates for Paul's life. And we don't actually have a lot of Paul's life between his early years and his persecution narrated for us. We have to piece that together. And then there's kind of a big chunk of time between this Paul showing up in Acts 8, Saul, and his conversion that we don't have. And then actually after his conversion, before he starts writing letters, we're missing kind of that big chunk of time too. So that sounds like a lot of ways of talking and things that we don't know. So maybe I'll say a few things that we do know from Acts. In addition to this 51 through and then 58 and 59, we learn from Acts 7, 58, so just before today's, or just before Acts 8, that Paul was a young man when he witnessed the Stephen being stoned to death. And if we take that precisely to be a young man within Judaism, within Greek thought, is between ages like 18 to 22, if that's a precise thing. So if we do that, then Paul was born maybe sometime around AD 10. Now, if it's not precise, then Paul could have been born, you know, sometime around the time of Jesus being born. It's hard to say with any precision. Acts also tells us that Saul was born in Tarsus. And Tarsus was a community in the diaspora. So then that's just a way of saying that he was born outside of Jerusalem, outside of the land of Israel. Tarsus is a prosperous city. It's a multicultural city. It's a city that has is home to various schools of rhetoric. There's a school of Stoic philosophy, and there's also apparently a minority community of Jews And we see all of those influences show up in Paul's letters, that this is a, you know, this is a city in the Roman Empire, that it has Greek thought, Greek influence, and that he is a Jew, a diasporan Jew. And Jews in the diaspora tended to live in separate neighborhoods. And that shouldn't, I think, be a surprising thing. We see that in immigrant communities all over the world, where you leave home and you end up in neighborhoods of people who live and eat and look and think like you do, right? Immigrants find immigrants. So Jews in the diaspora tend to live in separate neighborhoods, likely to preserve their own culture. And if Paul receives a standard Jewish education, that means that he was educated in his local synagogue, which in the first century functions more like a community center than a church. It's important to recognize that the synagogue is the place for education. It's the place for community gatherings. It's a place for service, for worship services, but even those look slightly different. And at this point in history, the locus of, or the, I guess the focus, the center point of Jewish worship is still the temple. So synagogue isn't, it's not competing with that in a sense. They serve slightly different purposes. So, so that would have taken place between ages 5 through 12. Paul would have been educated in his local synagogue if he follows, what we know of Jewish education at that time. He might have had a bar mitzvah at age 13, where he took upon himself the yoke of Terah, which he mentions in Acts 15:10, or Luke mentions. And then we have some glimpses in Acts also that give us a sense of what happens after that point in Paul's life, after he is bar mitzvahed. He might have moved by himself to Jerusalem fairly early in his life. Acts 22:3 mentions that he moves to Jerusalem. So he might have moved by himself to do that. He might have moved with his entire family to do that. And he does that to study under the rabbi Gamaliel. It was more common for families to travel together. But we know from Acts 23, 16, that Paul has a sister and she has a son, and they are also living in Jerusalem because they actually warn him of the plot against his life. So we have all these incidental details in Acts that give us a picture of what Paul's life was outside of his ministry and missionary journey. So it's either the case that Paul goes to study with Gamaliel and he's said to live with this sister, or he goes with his entire family. So if he's studying with a rabbi, that would have taken place between ages 13 and 18. And studying with a rabbi is, like, I guess the first century Jewish equivalent of like a seminary education, okay, which I always think is kind of interesting because I don't know many seminary students who would have been like ready for seminary at 13.
But, absolutely not.
but that is, that is when he would have done this. And he might also have, he does learn a trade, and he might have learned that perhaps during the 2 to 3 years after his initial schooling was complete and then moving to Jerusalem. So he learns tent making, likely from his father. Because in the ancient world, no one asked, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, if your father was a tent maker, then you learned to be a tent maker and you taught your son to be a tent maker and so on and so on and so forth. So it shouldn't maybe surprise us that Paul has a trade outside of being a rabbi, because rabbis were not paid. They were not compensated for their ministry. So not only do you have to go at 13 and learn to be a rabbi, but you're also not going to get paid for being a rabbi when you're done.
So to summarize, you're saying that, like, Paul grew up in Tarsus. At some point got an early education in Judaism as a cultural, you know, kind of as a religious cultural Jew in his local synagogue, moved to Jerusalem at some point before everything that happens in Acts, before all the controversy, that kind of stuff.
That's right.
Studies under a rabbi, so basically goes to seminary. I don't want to oversimplify it, but I think this is helpful for kind of understanding sort of why he then calls himself a Pharisee among Pharisees. Why he sort of says, you know, I really know my stuff. And so he's in Jerusalem now, learning more, picking up a trade of tent making. And then it between the ages of 18 to 22 is this young man that we meet in Acts 7, persecuting the followers of Jesus.
That's right.
What would his role as a Pharisee influence his like understanding of Jesus and his ability to engage with the arguments or like the plot line we get of Jesus?
Is this an inter-Jewish dispute? Yes, it is. Especially the picture that we get in Acts where, you know, we see the stoning of Stephen and then Saul persecuting the church. That's our, you know, first introduction to him. He is persecuting the church because he thinks they've gone astray within Judaism. This is a Jewish rebuke of another Jewish sect mm-hmm. that's happening. And Paul doesn't just say that he's a Pharisee. He says that he's a son of a Pharisee, or Luke says that he's a son of a Pharisee in Acts. So this isn't, it's a family tradition. Paul was born into a family and I totally agree, Monica, that we tend to vilify the Pharisees. And I think that's misguided for a lot of reasons, because actually, I mean, what I've just described is a young man who had just finished, in essence, his seminary education. So he has studied under a rabbi. He is ready to go. And every time I read, you know, these early depictions in Acts, I think of like Paul as the first century equivalent of someone like Helmut Tielicki's, you know, overzealous seminary student who really wants people to understand all the ways that they've misunderstood theology and just has zero grace to go with it.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, you know, Paul is like breathing out murderous thoughts. Like, okay, hopefully our seminary students aren't doing that. But his zeal for Torah, for the God of Israel, those things are not things that he loses in his conversion. We see them manifest in different ways, but I don't think that Paul undergoes this like radical personality shift when he comes to Christ. When he encounters Christ, he experiences a dramatic shift in orientation, but that zeal, that fire for preaching the God of Israel, who admittedly he now feels that he's encountered in Jesus, is the same zeal that we see in some ways in his persecution of the early church. And I don't think when Paul talks about, you know, his encounter with Christ, you never get a sense that he becomes not Jewish.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. And I realize now I'm getting into more of his own letters and not maybe what we see in Acts, where we don't have this language quite so much. But Paul is deeply concerned to be an apostle to the Gentiles, but that doesn't mean that he somehow becomes not Jewish, or that he's, I think more importantly, preaching a non-Jewish gospel.
Mm-hmm.
The gospel is deeply, deeply Jewish in Paul's mind. It is the fulfillment of the story of the God of Israel and his interaction and redemption of his creation.
Yeah.
And Paul is still thinking in Jewish categories. I often have, when I teach on Paul and in my introduction to Paul lecture, I have students like brainstorm how Paul's theology undergoes a shift in light of his conversion or encounter, however we're going to term what happens to him in the Damascus Road. And we talk about his shift in Christology and his shift in ecclesiology, so his understanding of who the people of God are, his shift in his eschatology, so how does his perception of like the end times or the end of the age change, and how does his soteriology change? How does his view of salvation change? And I think the biggest thing that people get tripped up on is that we think of Paul like not having a Christology, like not having an understanding of who Messiah was all of a sudden. And then, you know, all of a sudden he meets Jesus and like, oh, there's Christology. Well, no, we have Christology within Judaism. And what we have of these categories are not like new categories. What we have are revisions of very deeply Jewish categories. Mm. So it's not that we, you know, get a Christology all of a sudden. It's not that we have like a new understanding of the people of, I mean, we have a new understanding of the people of God. Like all of those categories undergo revision, sure, but they're still Jewish categories and Paul is still thinking in them.
Mm-hmm.
maybe it's partly because I've been away from the United States, but I'm seeing the United States look so divided. And it's interesting to sort of parallel that with this idea of like Jewishness at that point. And do we see fundamentally, like, do Americans see themselves as Americans? And did these Jews see themselves as Jews, like one with the other that they were disagreeing with? And it's caused a lot of thought for me lately, especially regarding like church leadership in places that could be very divided politically in a way that they feel they have no common ground. And I see Paul sort of being a bridge builder between that cultural gap sometimes. And even as a teenager, I had learned in church, you know, that Paul is why the Gentiles felt they had a right to access Jewish scripture. That was the bridge, like not just the Gospels and then the letters of Paul, but also the Torah, like that also can belong to Christians because of the bridge he built interculturally.
Yeah, I think we need to, I mean, Paul is the apostle to the Gentiles, and I think we would not have the same shape of Christianity now had it not been for his missionary journeys. I think that's true. And I think it is true in a sense that he opens the scriptures to the Gentiles. But I also would, I think I would want to say that we do have Christianity. We have those hints elsewhere in the New Testament, this kind of bridge building. I think in some sense we see that in the Gospel of Matthew, which has its own kind of issues with an inter-Jewish dispute and anti-Semitism, et cetera. I think we have it in Acts, in Luke, we have a positive picture of Gentiles, a positive picture of Rome. And even a book like Romans, Paul is writing Romans, and it's definitely a pro, you know, it's an inclusive document for Gentiles. But he's writing it to a church that's already been established and is a Gentile, you know, it's probably a Gentile, almost an exclusively Gentile church at the time that Paul is writing, because of some of the political happenings in the 50s in Rome. So I think, yes, Paul is the apostle to the Gentiles. Yes, he is a bridge builder. I think it would grieve Paul tremendously to see the church now be almost entirely devoid of Jewish culture, history, tradition, etc. Like, I don't think Paul's intention was to create a Gentile Christianity.
Right, the supersessionist sort of undercurrents in modern Christianity would be troubling to Paul.
Yeah, or even in like second century Christianity would be troubling to Paul. It happens very
Marcion
early on.
Marcion and that kind of those debates.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's one iteration of a millennia of this kind of problem. I mean, I think you get hints of this even in Romans, where you see the Gentile church that's trying to, in some sense, give up on Israel or doesn't understand its relationship with the people of Israel. Hence Romans 9 through 11. And Paul has very strong words there. He says, you know, would that I could cut myself off from Christ for the sake of my kinsfolk. Like, that's a big statement. I'm in unceasing anguish in my heart over them. So I think when we talk about Paul as a bridge builder, I think then we also need to reckon with this supersessionist tendency that we have. And I think that legacy would grieve Paul, and it should grieve us.
Almost,
as Gentile Christians.
Almost a reminder, even as we're reading Paul, almost to just go back and listen to the first 10 minutes of this podcast where we're talking about who Paul is and what his journey was like as a young Jewish man, up and through his conversion. That, like you said, he didn't change. He's the same Jewish young man that he was. And
yeah, that's right.
Jesus.
And he's passionate about that Christ comes for Jew and Gentile.
Yeah.
That Christ comes for everyone, because the God of Israel is passionately involved in his creation, both Jew and Gentile. And everything, you know, and everything that's not people in Paul's mind. That includes the cosmos. But that doesn't make him less Jewish.
if you had to nail Paul down on something as you're reading, kind of give you a something to hold on to as you're reading his letters, what might be things to help you look for or hold on to as you're reading his letters?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So I'll just say, I think that Paul wrote the letters that are attributed to him in the New Testament. And I think even in the pastoral epistles, I think that we don't have enough evidence to say that he didn't write them. So I'm happy to talk about especially the 10 letters of Paul instead of the 7 letters of Paul. Sure. So 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, I think, are interesting to consider together, precisely because you have this lively hope of return in the first instance, and you have this like language of judgment, which I think is interesting to consider, because whatever's happening in Thessalonica, Paul seems to think that like talking about judgment is actually a comfort for those people, that there will be kind of a reckoning for the evil that's being perpetrated for the early church. And it's interesting it's interesting to think if like he holds on to that as much, because in Romans, it seems like there's definitely talk of judgment, but there's also this all in Christ, all in Adam, and this language of all. I think his view of judgment in Romans, it undergoes. I think he's more interested in sin as a cosmic power, perhaps in Romans, than he is in Thessalonians. That like, it's almost like in his years of ministry, individual culpability is not even sufficient to talk about the evil of sin anymore.
Yes,
and when by the time we get to Romans, it's not just people are sinning, where, you know, they're committing acts of sin. It's sin as a noun. That is the subject of verbs that is enslaving people. And I wonder how much of Paul's intervening years of ministry and the hardship that he endures has influenced how he talks about something like sin and judgment. And it's interesting that he seems to have, in some sense, sin gets more sinful, but yeah, then grace gets bigger.
Mm-hmm. And they,
in
and
some
they,
ways,
they become less of individual actions, individual choices, and more these cosmic sort of capital S sin,
yes,
you know, capital G grace, these two sort of competing things that that are in this world.
Yeah, that's right. I think one of my teachers and friends, Beverly Gaventa, she always talks about, she gives the example of a child soldier who sins. What does it mean for a child soldier to be culpable for sins committed as a child soldier? And that's what she thinks is in mind when she thinks about sin in Paul, that sin just washes over all of creation and it enslaves us. And yet we do horrible things. You know, how much agency do we have in Paul's mind at that stage? I think we have culpability. Agency is a trickier thing. Paul seems to not see those things as contradictory, that we can have culpability without really being free.
Wow. That's so different from the way I had thought about this just as a layperson reading. I thought that big idea of sin was more about a collectivist culture, right? And they are going to see themselves as one group. And I would see myself as an individual, you know, separate from the group. But that's a very interesting point.
Yeah, I think Paul's understanding of what sin is does change within Judaism. And you don't see this in Second Temple literature, in other Jewish sources of the time, this idea that sin is a third agent, or the devil is a third agent. I think Paul has this he has a darker anthropology in some ways, and a darker harmatiology, a darker theology of sin than some Jewish sources of the age. He's less optimistic of what we're going to be capable of doing apart from the direct intervention of Jesus.
Apart from grace.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did Paul's life end? What do we know about the end of Paul's life?
we piece together things from, again, from kind of from Acts, kind of from his later letters, what we call the prison epistles. So Philippians, and I would put Philemon and Colossians and Ephesians in that category of prison epistles. Philippians was probably written a little bit later. If 2 Timothy is Pauline, we get hints of it in 2 Timothy also. And in those final letters of Paul's life, and then in Acts, where the close of Acts is Paul in prison in Rome, it seems like he has been put in prison, and then none of the letters, nor Acts, actually narrate what happens to him.
Right.
So we have to kind of go with church tradition, and there's very early church tradition on this, that Paul was executed in Rome under Nero during Nero's persecution, which happens mostly in and around Rome. So there, it's a fairly local thing, but if Paul's in Rome, then he would have been swept up in it. And if he was executed under Nero, it was probably sometime between like 64 and 67. Now, the big question is whether or not Paul's last imprisonment recorded in Acts is the last time Paul was in prison, or if that ends in his release and if he has other missionary journeys. If so, that would be a possible place to date the other pastoral epistles, 1 Timothy and Titus, and then his subsequent imprisonment would be where we would get a letter like 2 Timothy. Or it's possible that Luke has theological reasons for not narrating what happens to Paul at the end of his imprisonment, that he doesn't narrate his execution, because the point in Acts is not that Paul is executed. The point in Acts is that the gospel goes forward unchained.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say exactly what happens. I think what all of the traditions, the sources that we have in the New Testament point to is that Paul actually did die. which I think, sounds kind of obvious, except that there are people in the, Bible who don't die. So, it's not an entirely foregone conclusion. But so Paul he dies. Most people agree that he's martyred. Because Paul is a Roman citizen, which was not true of Jesus, was not true of the other apostles, he would not have been subjected probably to crucifixion, which was a death that was not permissible for Roman citizens to be subjected to, because it was so dehumanizing and humiliating. So Paul would have been allowed a more dignified death, probably by beheading. So he's, most people think that he's been, that he was beheaded or executed under Nero. In the mid-60s.
All right.
And actually, it's really interesting. You can go to Rome and you can visit two sites that give you kind of they're not, no site for New Testament. There's, usually there's like at least three sites that you can visit for any one thing that's mentioned in the Bible. And, if there's three sites, then you know that it's a genuine place, but you don't know if any of the three sites are like actually genuinely the place.
Yes.
So one of the places that you can visit in Rome, or at least you could before, Corona time, is Mamertine Prison, where church tradition holds that Paul and Peter were both imprisoned. And you can also go visit a really interesting site called the Church of St. Paul Outside the Walls, that it has a reasonable claim that it was the final resting place of Paul the Apostle. And if it's not, then, worst thing that's happened is you've gone to a beautiful church.
What a joy it was to have Aaron join us this week for the podcast. If you want to hear more from our conversation, be sure to join our Bible Project 2020 group on Facebook. We'll be sharing an additional conversation we had about the rhythm of daily life for Paul and others in his culture. We're still worshiping online Sundays at 9:30 and 11 a.m. You can join us on Facebook or at hydeparkumc.org/live. You can also connect with us on Facebook, search for the Bible Project 2020 and request to join. Matt Hotho produced this episode. I'm Monica Largesse. See you next week.